All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable William M. Mormon presiding. All who have business before this court draw near and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. You may be seated.
Good morning. To my right is Judge Davis and to my left is Judge Sholin. We're here today in the matter of Angela S. Brady versus Eric K. Shinseki, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, docket number 092480. Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record?
Sandra Booth, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Angelina Brady.
Thank you.
This is Brady, so we have the co-counsel, Deputy Assistant General Counsel, Joe Moriarty.
Thank you. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, for the appellant, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
15 minutes, Your Honor.
15 minutes.
If I may.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. There are two issues before the court today. Number one, is Mrs. Brady entitled to an order of enforcement of the court's February 2009 remand order? And number two, should the secretary's conduct in this case and at the agency be sanctioned? Essential to both of those remedies is that the appellant must show that there was a clear and unambiguous court order. This case meets that requirement. The February 2009 court remand order incorporated the parties' joint motion for remand. That joint motion for remand contained the secretary's concession of BVA error with respect to the board's finding that there was no pending unadjudicated TDIU claim at the time of the veteran's death. The remand order goes on to provide affirmatively that there was such a claim, pending unadjudicated TDIU, pending for more than 10 years before the veteran's death. The clear and unambiguous order then is brought full circle by the court's, by the JMR language, which the court incorporated, which ordered readjudication of Mrs. Brady's Section 1318 claim based on the 10-year rule in light of the fact that the veteran had a pending unadjudicated TDIU claim for more than 10 years at the time of his death.
If I can interject at this point.
Certainly.
So the veteran had a pending claim, and then the veteran, an unadjudicated pending claim, we'll assume that,
mm-hmm.
and then the veteran passed away.
Yes.
Would the logical next step have been for her to pursue an accrued benefits claim based on his unadjudicated pending claim?
She filed, I believe, the formal VA form, DIC claim form, which includes an accrued benefits claim. That's never been adjudicated. And until such time as we had a concession from the secretary that there was a pending unadjudicated claim, I don't think she had an accrued benefits claim. There was no entitlement to accrued benefits until we resolved the issue of whether there was a pending unadjudicated claim at the time of his death.
So is it your position that now she has a pending accrued benefits claim?
I would expect to assert that. It would certainly be limited by the two-year rule in her case back at the agency. There are some issues with that. I'm not sure how that's going to play out.
Does the court's prior decision that affirmed the automobile assistance accrued benefits claim bar this alternate theory of accrued benefits now?
No, it does not, Your Honor. And the reason is this. The court's first decision held that the automobile benefits claim was not within the umbrage of an accrued benefit. That's the important issue to be. So there was no accrued benefit based on that claim. The entitlement to have VA pay that claim arose separately under statute, and the claim, the payment was owed to the seller of the automobile, not to Mrs. Brady. So as I read that original decision regarding the accrued benefits, it is limited, confined to the issue of the automobile payment.
Under which provision of 3.22 are you arguing now that she's entitled to DIC?
Under the provision that the veteran had, if his claim is adjudicated, it's going to adjudicated favorably to her, then she will meet the 10-year rule that the veteran received or was entitled to receive benefits at the 100 total disability rate for 10 years. Now, I think there is an issue that I'm sure motivated that question, Your Honor, in which I saw...
I hope so.
...which I saw last night, too, and it's premature to reach it, assuming we're talking about the same issue, and that is whether or not this claim, whether when a veteran dies with a pending unadjudicated claim, which once adjudicated posthumously, would qualify the widow for the 1318 10-year rule. Does Section 1318, and in particular 3.22, bar a widow from establishing entitlement based on a pending unadjudicated claim?
And your answer to that question is?
My answer is that it does not. That if 3.22, because of its definition of entitled to receive, if it bars a claim that is based on pending an unadjudicated at the time of death, it is an impermissibly narrow reading of the statute. The other argument I would make would be that the in receipt of language as used in 1318 would also encompass constructive receipt, such that a pending claim adjudicated after the veteran's death would also qualify as constructive receipt.
Now that we've touched on that, and since no one in the briefing has touched on NOVA 1, 2, or 3, in fairness to counsel, since I came to this late myself, I have copies, just in case you do not, of NOVA 1, 2, and 3 for each of you, because I think we're going to get into a discussion of those cases. Okay, so then what you're saying, counsel, is that notwithstanding the fact that there are 8 exceptions to the rule stated in 3.22, 2 major exceptions, and then I'll list of 6 others, the Secretary impermissibly narrowed the reading of the statute in his promulgation of the regulation.
Well, I'm not saying that today for purposes of this argument, because that issue hasn't been yet... It's premature in this case. Mrs. Brady, our position is entitled to an adjudication based on the 2009 remand order. Now, the board may well determine that, number one, the evidence does not support a referral to 4.16B. The veteran did not have the qualifying rating under 4.16A. So the board may well decide that the evidence doesn't support a referral under 4.16B. That may be what its adjudication is. The board may well decide that it does support referral, in which case the director of CMP will have to make the initial decision, and then the board can review it on the merits, assuming
well,
that...
Well, let's assume that everybody agrees that he would have been entitled to TDIU going back to 1985.
Mm-hmm.
How does that then bootstrap you into her DIC entitlement, if that's adjudicating his claim?
Because that's going to be, we're assuming, again, as the court ordered in the remand order, that the TDIU is pending and unadjudicated for more than 10 years before his death. So arbitrarily, let's pick the 1985 date. It could be later, it could be earlier. That claim is pending and unadjudicated. If the VA makes a decision which is favorable and agrees that he was entitled to TDIU under 4.16B, that establishes that, again, this is what I was responding to Judge Mormon earlier, her entitlement arises under two or three different theories. Number one, the in receipt of language under 1318 should not be so narrowly construed as to exclude a posthumous decision on a pending and unadjudicated claim. Number two, that if it's an entitled to receive issue, then the secretary has impermissibly narrowed the entitled to receive definition. And in fact, I don't think that was even what the secretary intended with the 3.22 amendments.
Well, if I can just sort of interrupt, sort of getting back to what you said to me, was that if his claim was adjudicated, it would thus create that he was receiving 100% for 10 years prior to his death, which would then establish the criteria under 1318. But there's lots of other ways that people can get 10 years of benefits. Somebody could file a brand new claim, but that was found to be not allowed under Rodriguez-Tarver regulation.
Correct.
And all that.
Correct.
So the fact that he had something pending, I need you to convey to me, how is that different than filing a new claim or one of the other, how is this one of the exceptions that is allowed under 3.22, or is it not allowed under 3.22 but should be?
3.22, according to Rodriguez, and I think that's affirmed, or that's supported by the NOVA 1, 2, and 3, like probably NOVA 3 decision. The 3.22 amendments were intended to remove the hypothetical entitlement theory. That was the purpose of them. The board even acknowledges that in its 2009 decision.
But in that 2009 decision, didn't the board assert that what it was looking at was nothing more than a claim for hypothetical entitlement in sheep's clothing?
Well, it's not in sheep's clothing if the definition of hypothetical entitlement is reviewed, and that definition is a claim that could have been asserted by the veteran during his lifetime but never was, and that's not this case by the concession that it's pending and unadjudicated. It was obviously asserted. Or under hypothetical entitlement, that there has been a final decision in the claim. And again, if it's pending and unadjudicated, it cannot have been a final decision. There cannot have been a final decision on this claim. Now, there are some exceptions in both of those that 3.22 contemplates, but not applicable under the facts of this case. But that's the hypothetical entitlement theory, a claim never asserted by the veteran during his lifetime, or a claim asserted and denied and no longer and final and therefore no longer pending.
Why, in the JMR, at record 69, the JMR says that the case is remanded for re-adjudication in light of the party's agreement. Why wasn't the re-adjudication that the board did the re-adjudication that was contemplated?
Because the remand required a re-adjudication in light of the fact that the veteran had a pending, unadjudicated TDIU claim for more than 10 years. The board's re-adjudication expressly rejected that finding of fact and made a new decision on the assumption that he did not have a pending and unadjudicated claim for at least 10 years, for more than 10 years. That's the essential benefit of this remand to Mrs. Brady, and that's what the board said was erroneous, that it had already decided that in its 2007 board decision, which had been vacated by the 2009 CAVC remand. The board said that the court was in error in making that, adopting that part of its the remand in its order of remand.
But doesn't this court's decision in Chisholm contemplate that there are circumstances where later decisions of the Federal Circuit could trump decisions of this court, and that the board could apply the Federal Circuit decisions rather than the decisions of this court?
Certainly could, but there is no subsequent decision. Tarver is the only subsequent decision. Tarver pushed back at the appellant's, the claimant's effort to create an exception to Rodriguez, and Tarver applied Rodriguez. But this still goes back to the fact that once the secretary conceded that the TDIU claim was pending and unadjudicated, it took it completely out of the purview of hypothetical entitlement. A claim that's pending is not a hypothetical claim.
Ms. Booth, you were listing a number of reasons why your client was entitled to DIC. You got through two in receipt of and entitled to receive. Did you have another reason? Do you recall?
No, the language, the in receipt of language and the entitled to receive language, those are the two triggering factors, and our contention would be that the posthumous adjudication of a claim that was pending at the time of death is contemplated by one or the other, certainly.
Okay.
If VA went ahead and adjudicated this pending claim, mm-hmm. would Mrs. Brady be allowed to submit additional evidence to support this claim?
I believe that she would, just as VA would be allowed to develop, for example, a vocational report or obtain a medical opinion regarding the issue of unemployability. So, yes, I think that she could. The claim's still pending. It's open.
If you look at the language in NOVA 3, it talks about what the court, the Federal Circuit, found compelling about the VA's rationale. Sorry, Judge Moorman, I see that I'm out of time.
Let's add 3 minutes.
Thank you. That the retroactivity portion of it was what they found most compelling, that they thought Q was an okay reason, mm-hmm. that submitting new medical records was an okay reason, but that new material evidence was not a compelling retroactivity because there could end up being protracted evidentiary discussions and development and debate that would sort of throw the result into uncertainty for a long time. Mm-hmm. Would that not be the same circumstance that could happen here if she's allowed to submit new evidence?
Well, I don't think so, because what NOVA 3 was talking about was, again, a claim that has become final. So the exceptions, which are in 3.22, are CUE, arguing CUE, which is not available unless you have a final decision, or very, very narrow exception for new material evidence based on service records for reopening, but otherwise barring all other reopening. But again, we're talking about a final decision, how to get around finality. In this case, there is a concession that the TDIU is not final. For that reason, I would think that...
So allowing protracted evidentiary development wouldn't be a concern because it's not final?
No more than it would be in any other, than it would have been had the veteran survived, and we were here today talking about whether he was entitled to have TDIU adjudicated back in the 1980s.
And actually, in NOVA 3, in footnote 7, since we're going to be talking about it here in a minute, Judge Dyke presciently observed that they express no opinion, for example, on whether a surviving spouse or other DIC claimant could claim benefits under the statute if an original disability claim had been pending for more time than the requisite period of years before the veteran's death and should have been resolved in the veteran's favor. In such circumstances, a claim could be argued to have a retroactive effect for the required period of years. Seems to me, I understand your argument that we're not there yet, but it seems to me that there's some applicability to this case in regard to that footnote.
I'm sorry, did you say that was footnote 7?
Footnote 7, NOVA 3. Thank you. in further recognition that perhaps VA had not thought of all possible contingencies when it promulgated its regulation.
Looking at the last decision, and I'm not finding a footnote.
Well, you'll have some time to find that because
your
time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And add 3 minutes to VA's time as well, please. Counsel?
Good morning. May I please the court? My name is Tamika Springs, and I represent the Secretary of the Department of Affairs. To my right is Co-Counsel, Deputy Assistant General Counsel John Moriarty. Appellant is seeking entitlement to survivor benefits under 38 U.S.C. 1318.
As counsel on this case, do you have the authority to bind the secretary? If you enter into an agreement, do you have the authority to bind the secretary?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if you enter into an agreement with the other party, is that agreement binding on the board as well?
Yes, Your Honor. However, Your Honor, in this case, it's the Secretary's position that the law issued in Tolliver, Your Honor, was needed to be applied in this case, Your Honor.
That's not what the board said, though, is it?
Yes, Your Honor. The board found that controlling law issued after the JMR was on point with this case, Your Honor, that Tolliver controlled the outcome of this case.
Well, didn't the board say that actually the board got it right 2 years earlier than that and then quoted at length its prior decision and said, we had the law right. And therefore, we're not bound by what was decided in this JMR. Isn't that what the board said?
Yes, Your Honor. That is what the board stated. But it's the Secretary's position, Your Honor, that the board did comply with the terms of the JMR, Your Honor. The terms of the JMR worked. The terms of the JMR required the board to address the issue of whether the unemployability should be referred to direct NCMP, Your Honor. The board found, in light of relevant case law, that the issue could not be referred to direct NCMP.
Because?
Because the JMR, Your Honor, JMR amounted to hypothetical entitlement, Your Honor. The JMR into the secretary.
So you disagree with Ms. Booth that there's no issue of hypothetical entitlement here, that pending unadjudicated claim is something different than hypothetical entitlement?
Your Honor, yes.
They're the same? Hypothetical entitlement and pending unadjudicated claim?
Well, Your Honor, it was the Secretary's position that the only way that the JMR was entered into at that time was to address the theory of hypothetical entitlement. Prior to the JMR,
is there anywhere in the JMR that hypothetical entitlement is mentioned?
No, Your Honor. The exact words of hypothetical entitlement are not mentioned. However, on the first page, Your Honor, record at 66, the JMR does state 1318 and the 10-year rule, Your Honor. In light of the fact that when the JMR was issued, Your Honor, Rodriguez was controlling law. However, it left open the possibility as to whether in this current case, appellant filed her claim after Green but before the amendment, Your Honor. Once Tolliver was issued, Your Honor, that became the controlling law in this case.
But wasn't the real linchpin in this JMR Comer?
Your Honor, that's what the JMR stated. However, Your Honor, the 1318 was referred, and the only clear instruction in the JMR was for the board to address whether the issue of unemployability should be referred to director of compensation and pension. Your Honor. That was the only clear instruction, Your Honor. The board complied with this instruction.
So what's the court supposed to do with all this language that the board member put in here? To the extent that the board member is free to ignore the order of the court, the JMR, etc.
Your Honor, is the Secretary's position that the board had no authority whatsoever to state that language, Your Honor, or to make those conclusions? As those statements are conclusions of law, Your Honor, this court may strike or find those statements erroneous. But the main reason that the board found in denying the claim to direct and compensation and pension, Your Honor, was correct.
The appellant suggests that we ought to sanction the secretary.
We would argue no, Your Honor, because the board did comply with the GMR, Your Honor. The board found that the relevant case law, which applied in this case, was Tolliver, Your Honor. However, if this court finds that the board did not comply with the GMR, the board didn't comply with the GMR, Your Honor, because they couldn't, because of the relevant case law that was issued, Your Honor. So sanctions aren't appropriate, Your Honor, in this case.
Okay, let's talk for a minute about, you've had a chance to look at footnote 7, I think, in NOVA 3 now, haven't you?
Very briefly, Your Honor.
Okay.
With regards to that, Your Honor, if I may speak on that.
Sure.
It's the Secretary's position, Your Honor, that 3.22 is controlling in this decision, Your Honor. Appellant is stating that she's seeking benefits based on entitlement to compensation for a service-connected disability that was continuously rated for 10 years or more immediately preceding his death. VA has issued a regulation 3.2, which defines entitled to receive, Your Honor. Specifically, Your Honor, it defines entitlement to receive as a veteran who filed a claim during his or her lifetime and, Your Honor, and is very important in this case, Your Honor, that one of the following circumstances is satisfied. That one of the following circumstances are satisfied. One is that the veteran would have TDIU but for Q in a prior VA decision, or that additional submission of service department records that were in existence at the time of a prior VA decision but not considered by the board, or for other matters unrelated to the merits of this case, Your Honor. And it's the Secretary's
VA didn't have an easy row to hoe in getting this rule through the Federal Circuit, did it?
No, Your Honor, it did not.
Okay, so when they got up there for the third time with a proposed rule, and Judge Dyke wrote, our holding in this respect does not, of course, foreclose an individual claimant from seeking to establish a right to compensation under Section 1311 and 1318 on the ground that the regulations are unduly limiting and hence invalid as applied because the regulations fail to recognize an additional retroactivity situation present in the particular case, but not covered by the regulations. What was he trying to tell us? And that's where he dropped the footnote.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not clear at this point. However, I do know, Your Honor, the Secretary's position is that 3.22 is controlling, Your Honor. There is nothing that the appellant can show, Your Honor, that fits her into any of the exceptions of this case, Your Honor, under 1318, which is what the appellant is pursuing her claim under, Your Honor.
Well, I'd like to pick up on something that the appellant said earlier. She said that the Secretary's admission that Mr. Brady had filed and was left with a pending unadjudicated claim in the JMR potentially created an accrued benefits claim based on that TDIU unadjudicated claim. Would you agree with that?
No, Your Honor. The Secretary's response is the accrued claim, I'm not familiar with the statute, leaves me at this point, Your Honor, but the appellant had 1 year from the time of the veteran's death to file an accrued benefits claim.
Well, didn't she do that in conjunction with her DIC claim?
She did it with the automobile, Your Honor, and that claim was granted, Your Honor. However, no issue with regards to a TDIU was ever brought up by the appellant with regards to the accrued.
Is that level of specificity required in an accrued benefits claim? Doesn't it pertain to all pending claims that the veteran had at the time of death?
The Secretary's position, Your Honor, is that it does require that.
Level of specificity?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, let's just say she had an accrued benefits claim pending, for the sake of argument, and the Secretary adjudicated it, awarded her the 2 years of entitlement that she would receive based under accrued benefits. But the effective date would be back to 1985 when the veteran filed his claim for TDIU. Would that then allow her to gain entitlement to benefits under 1318?
Your Honor, no. In that hypothetical, under 1318, Your Honor, she still would have to show entitlement to compensation, Your Honor. And entitlement to compensation is divided, entitlement to compensation, Your Honor, is defined in 3.22. And that goes back to the exceptions, Your Honor, where there is cue in a decision, whether there is additional documents submitted or other.
Does she even need to go to that, though? Because then at that point, wouldn't the veteran have been in receipt or because the VA had adjudicated that the TDIU was effective in 1985, that he would have been 100% for more than 10 years?
Yeah, that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so she would be entitled to DIC, and VA would adjudicate that claim?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
The Secretary would ask that this court affirm the mate.
You're not done yet. Nice try. Now, let's go down the road that the appellant is arguing, that this is some sort of pending claim that is only for the purposes of 1318, not necessarily for the purposes of accrued benefits, and that VA should adjudicate the TDIU claim. It should be referred to the director of CMP. And let's assume that that has to happen. I know that that is very far from where you need to be, but I'm just trying to flesh out,
okay,
if this were to happen, what would the consequences of it be? And I'm going to ask you what I asked her, which is, if we were in that context, much like if we're in the context for new service records being allowed under 3.22 as a basis for going back and awarding DIC, because I'm not aware of the answer in that context, I think it might allow for this. And I'm sorry I'm confusing you because I'm confusing myself. So would she be allowed to submit additional evidence in furtherance of her pending and adjudicated claim if it were necessary? Okay, let me ask you a more basic question. Under 3.22,
okay,
there's an exception for new service records as a basis for retroactivity.
Well, I read 3.2 as saying additional service department records that the VA had, Your Honor.
Okay.
In their custody, Your Honor, not new records, Your Honor.
Okay, well, I'll take that as true. But so then VA is adjudicating that claim. In the context of that, is the claimant allowed to submit additional evidence to establish her entitlement to DIC?
No, Your Honor, not under 3.22.
Can you tell me where it limits the ability to submit additional evidence?
Well, the statute, Your Honor.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Here it says B2, additional evidence submitted to VA before or after the veteran's death consisting solely of service department records. So this could be submitted after the veteran's death.
If there are service department records,
right, right,
in the custody,
right,
of VA, Your Honor, yes.
Yes. So does that, where in that does it limit it only to the service records as opposed to additional evidence that might be, since De La Rosa and others have found that there is some potential duty to assist to DIC claimants?
I would just say that I would point to the language, Your Honor. The language is specific and it states that it's limited to, well, it doesn't state limited, but it says service department records at the time the board decision was in existence or were in the custody of VA, Your Honor.
I don't think it goes that far, but I think that's all we're going to get.
Is it the Secretary's position that any previously unadjudicated TDIU claim could not last beyond the veteran's death?
Yes, Your Honor.
And your reason for saying that is?
As the board noted, Your Honor, there is case law which supports that decision, Your Honor.
Do you think that leaves someone like Mrs. Brady without a remedy?
No, Your Honor. She has a remedy, Your Honor. According to 1318 and 3.22, the appellant can file a Q with the 1996 November decision with regards to the TDIU, Your Honor. That would be her remedy in this case.
Well, hasn't this court in Ingram found that, and DiCarlo, that the appropriate action when there is a pending unadjudicated claim is to ask the agency to adjudicate it, that there's no finality, so there can't be Q?
Well, Well, Your Honor, it's the Secretary's position that there is no pending claim, Your Honor, at this time.
So what was the decision?
What
was the decision in the 1985 claim? If it's not pending, it has to be decided. Yes.
Well, the appellant was granted TDIU, Your Honor, in 1996.
So that claim subsumed the 1985 claim?
Yeah, it extinguished any pending claim, Your Honor, that the veteran had, Your Honor.
So in the JMR, when the Secretary agreed that there was a pending unadjudicated claim, that was not accurate?
Your Honor, that goes to the Secretary's theory as to why it's hypothetical entitlement, because that would be the only way that the Secretary would agree there was a pending claim, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, it's either pending or it's not. It's either subsumed or it's not. It's either decided in the subsequent claim or it's not. It doesn't get to be for one purpose and not for the other, right?
Well, the Secretary's position is there is no pending claim, Your Honor. Maybe the terms of the JMR, as far as the exact words pending, was inartfully worded, Your Honor, but the JMR was trying to get back to the early effective date for the appellant, Your Honor, to have entitlement to DIC in the 1318 with regards to the hypothetical entitlement theory. It's kind of a circular argument, Your Honor.
The JMR was pretty darn specific, counsel, with regard to what the findings of fact were, and I just have a hard time following the idea that the JMR was somehow inartfully worded with regard to pending unadjudicated claim. The parties agree that the board erred in finding that an unadjudicated extra-scheduler claim to include TDIU had not been raised at least 10 years before the veteran's death. And I think the JMR says that at least three times.
Yes, Your Honor, but it's secretary.
And now we're going to walk away from that or allow the board to walk away from that by saying, well, that's really hypothetical entitlement?
Your Honor, it's the Secretary's position that that was conceded for the purpose of hypothetical entitlement theory, Your Honor. That will be the only way, Your Honor, in the Secretary's position that the JMR is to be read in light of the case law, Your Honor. So, yes, the JMR conceded a pending claim, but it was for the purposes of hypothetical entitlement theory.
The Secretary, in promulgating 3.22, did some other things that were unheard of previously, like saying somebody post-death could file a Q claim, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the Federal Circuit said in passing judgment on the validity of 3.22, be careful here. There might be other circumstances that we haven't contemplated. And by the way, one that occurs to me, Judge Dyke, is the one that is in front of us today.
Your Honor, even if there was a hypothetical entitlement theory, Your Honor, and it was sent back to the Director of CMP, Your Honor, that still does not get you to 3.22 because there still is no exception, Your Honor. It's a pending, unadjudicated, it says entitlement to service connection means that the veteran during his lifetime filed a claim for disability compensation and one of the following criteria, Your Honor. It still would not meet the exceptions to 3.22, even if it was sent back, Your Honor, even conceding there was a pending claim, Your Honor.
I will give you that the narrow issue before us today is whether or not the board complied with the JMR and whether or not the board was contemptuous in doing so or not doing so. Tell me once more, please, how the board complied with this JMR that said you have to treat this claim. The parties agree that this claim involves a situation where there's a pending unadjudicated claim for benefits that dates back more than 10 years. Tell me how you get from that statement to the board saying, no, I'm not going to apply that.
Okay.
And not have a problem with either compliance or contempt.
Your Honor, the Secretary's position that the only way the JMR would have is entered into was put, was for hypothetical entitlement.
Where does it say that, counsel?
Section 13, page 66 of the words of, excuse me, of the JMR states 1318. No, the specific wording of hypothetical entitlement is not used, Your Honor. However, the pending claim died with the veteran, as the board correctly noted. There was no way for the appellant to get to get entitlement unless for hypothetical entitlement, Your Honor. So prior to when the parties entered the JMR, Your Honor, Rodriguez had been issued. That case dealt with where an appellant filed a claim, but before Green and before the amendment. So after Rodriguez, hypothetical entitlement theory was still a viable option, as in the case for the appellant. In the appellant's case, she filed her claim after the Green line of cases, but before the amendment. So, Your Honor, in theory, when the JMR was issued, there was still a window open for hypothetical entitlement theory, Your Honor. After the decision in Tauber, Your Honor, the decision closed that window. There was no longer a question as whether to, as whether the amendment at 3.22 would apply to a claim where an appellant filed a claim after Green but before the amendment, Your Honor. On that basis, Your Honor, the board had to go with the controlling law, Your Honor, in this case, and that is why the board complied with the decision, Your Honor. The board was to address whether or not the issue of unemployability should be referred to director of CMP. Because of the controlling law issue, Your Honor, after the parties initiated the JMR, Your Honor, the board could not, by law, Your Honor, refer that to the, that issue to the director of CMP, Your Honor. That's the secretary's position as to why the board complied with the JMR, Your Honor. There was law that left a window open, Your Honor, when the JMR was issued. So there was hypothetical entitlement theory still was a viable option. It's the secretary's position, Your Honor, the JMR dealt with hypothetical entitlement theory. And after Tauber, Your Honor, that window was closed. It was a controlling law. Appellant's case is similar to Tauber. The board found that, and the board, based on that decision, could not refer the issue. And the only specific instruction in the JMR, Your Honor, was for the board to address that issue, which it did, Your Honor.
Counsel, I admire your ability to try to defend what appears to me to be fairly indefensible. I don't see any way you can read this JMR as suggesting any kind of hypothetical entitlement. And there's nothing in the JMR that discusses Rodriguez, mentions Rodriguez, mentions hypothetical entitlements. And as Judge Mormon indicated, this clearly is a JMR that's in the context of an unadjudicated TDIU claim pending at the time. What, again, I admire your ability to try to defend this, but I'm a little disappointed that that's a position that the office is taking on this JMR. It's a rationalization for a JMR that was not enforced by the board, and in my view, that's indefensible. And I'm curious to know, well, I'm curious to talk a little bit about sanctions, actually, because when I look at the language in the board's opinion, the board very directly discusses why it is not required to follow the instructions of the court and why, in essence, the court has erred in its construction of the law. Why is it that you don't believe there should be sanctions in place against the secretary for this board opinion?
Well, Your Honor, the secretary's position is that the board was clearly wrong, Your Honor. They wholeheartedly lack authority, Your Honor, to state that this court's instructions were erroneous as well as the JMR, Your Honor. That's the secretary's position on that issue, Your Honor. The secretary believes that the board still, Your Honor, provided an analysis as to why the issue, which was addressed in the JMR, the issue, Your Honor, in the JMR, the board was to address whether or not the issue of unemployability should be referred to the director of CMP. That was what the board was to address, Your Honor.
Right.
The board addressed this issue, Your Honor, and finding that because of new law, they could not, Your Honor, refer the issue to director of CMP. So the board complied with the only specific instruction, Your Honor, in the JMR. So that's the secretary's decision, Your Honor, that the board did comply with the JMR. And if they didn't comply with the JMR, they couldn't, Your Honor, because the controlling law issued after the JMR was entered, Your Honor. That's the secretary's position, Your Honor. Yes,
the board got there because the board went off on this hypothetical entitlement path, right? And
yes.
Followed Rodriguez, which wasn't mentioned in the JMR, and Tarver. Okay. I understand your position. I'm not persuaded, but I understand it. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. The secretary would ask that you affirm the May 2009 board decision.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Having had a chance to review the footnote in NOVA 3, I would agree that that is precisely the situation that we have here. I do think that deciding that issue is premature because we don't yet have a decision on unemployability. So until we do, and that was what Mrs. Brady was entitled to get after the last remand, until we do, whether or not that unemployability will fall within the section, the purview of Section 3.22, whether or not it's invalid to the because it improper or impermissibly limits 1318 are all questions down the road. The board certainly has never considered whether 3.22, as it is written now, can nevertheless be reconciled with the situation that Judge Dyke is talking about in footnote 7. It may be that we can persuade the board that they are capable of a reconciliation. And if not, then potentially this case will be back here down
counsel,
the road.
When I look at the Federal Register regarding the adoption of the rule 3.22 and the statute 1318, there's a lot of explanation in the Federal Register regarding the intent and the legislative history that surrounded the statute and the regulations, and there's a lot of discussion regarding finality, final decisions, mm-hmm. In that Federal Register. So does the fact that there was not a final decision in this instance, that there was a pending TDIU claim, make a difference in terms of the application of retroactivity here?
Well, I think it does not, Your Honor. And I think it does not because the statute contemplates a veteran who is in receipt of or entitled to receive. The board, I believe, uses the phrase actual receipt. I don't think that's found in the statute or in the regs. And again, the notion that the secretary may exclude a whole swath of veterans who died during these very lengthy administrative proceedings, as we all know, occur at the VA, that he might die before he gets his favorable decision, and that would exclude his wife from relying on the husband, as the case may be, relying on the 10-year rule, just does not seem to make sense to me as being consistent with what Congress intended.
Well, doesn't the remedy for that under the scheme come in accrued benefits? That the spouse files for accrued benefits, the remainder of the adjudication is completed. If they are eligible, they not only gain the time necessary for 1318, but depending when they veteran passed, 1 year, 2 years, or the entire amount of the accrued benefits.
Well, yes, but I think that's the very situation we have here. In this case, the accrued benefits claim was part of the original DIC claim filed with 1 year of the veteran's death. VA has never, except for one brief shining moment in the JMR, acknowledged there even was a claim. So that issue has never been adjudicated because VA, there was no agreement that such a claim even existed.
Right, but that doesn't mean that she, assuming it's all, as said, doesn't have an accrued benefits claim.
No, it does not assume
so
that she does not.
So then wouldn't it be premature to decide the DIC portion of it?
I think those two issues, Your Honor, could be decided simultaneously. We have a concession. There is a pending unadjudicated claim. Whether or not that gets her to the 100% total disability level.
Right, because they could find that he gets TDIU, but only back to 1992
sure.
or something.
Sure, he could. They could. They could not, because that was part of the Secretary's concession, too, that TDI. Oh, wait, I'm sorry.
No, I'm saying yes. that he had the claim, but that the eligibility wasn't actually,
yes.
hypothetically
yes.
speaking,
yes.
not to use a loaded word.
yes, you're correct.
But the one circumstance that I see your case being, that I see being very compelling would be if somebody didn't file an accrued benefits claim within a year,
mm-hmm.
and then they were trying to find DIC based on an adjudicated claim. They wouldn't be able to pursue that.
They would not be able to rely on the existence of an accrued benefits claim. That's correct. So then we would be back to a straight-on interpretation of 1318 and 3.22 along the lines of what we've discussed for most of this argument. Yes.
Counsel, could you turn with me, if you will, to page 876 of NOVA 3?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes,
The paragraph on the column that begins, while some of VA's rationales for limiting?
Yes.
If you go down that paragraph to the sentence that starts with our holding in this respect?
Yes.
Does not, of course, foreclose an individual claimant from seeking to establish a right to compensation under Section 1311, 1318 on the ground that the regulations are unduly limiting because the regulations fail to recognize an additional retroactivity situation present in the particular case but not covered by the regulations. I've kind of called this let me ask the question, do you see this as a... another exception to the regulations, an exception that in essence says if you have facts that fit, you might make a case for retroactivity application?
I see this case, I'm not sure what precisely you're asking me. I see this case as coming within either an in receipt of construing the statute as constructive receipt, which would open the door to the retroactive application, or the regulation is invalid because it impermissibly limits the entitled to receive only to CUE and new material evidence under the very narrow circumstances listed by the regulation, but fails to recognize the entitled to receive criterion in light of a pending unadjudicated claim, which is not adjudicated until the veteran has died. This particular situation, by the way, if we assume that the Secretary's position is correct, would also bar a veteran who has, for example, say my regional office, Cleveland VA Regional Office Rating Board, makes a 100% TDIU award back 10 years, but does not know that the veteran died the day before. So under those circumstances, the position of the Secretary would exclude that circumstance, would also exclude the circumstance where the rating board makes a favorable decision. The veteran dies a week later before the VA has processed the award. And if we strictly apply the statute as the Secretary would urge, the veteran was not in receipt of his compensation, even though he had been adjudicated as entitled to it. That would also bar the wife or the spouse from establishing 1318 benefits under the 10-year rule. I just think both of those results, as well as the result in this case, is far beyond what the statute intended to limit and truly was not contemplated by the Secretary's amendments. else Judge Dyke would not have made that footnote.
Okay. Thank you.
Having kind of launched us down this rabbit trail into issues not necessarily currently before the court, now let me try and bring us back to the issue that is before the court, and that is we're reviewing this board decision. And notwithstanding the fact that I have my fingers stuck in six pages of this board decision that bother me, nevertheless, the government's argument is the board member made the right final decision because she applied the regulation and the statute, and they didn't provide for the situation that we have here. And therefore, based on Tarver, having been decided after the JMR, there is no entitlement under 1318 to relief in this case. What's your answer to that?
My answer to that, Your Honor, is that the only way that argument gets any traction is if we redraft, reform the joint motion for remand. Once the pending unadjudicated claim concession was made, it is not a hypothetical entitlement claim anymore. That doesn't automatically follow that there is entitlement under 1318 and 3.22, but it removes it from the hypothetical entitlement bar. At that point, the pending and unadjudicated claim is outside the box.
But then don't you have to find something under 3.22 that applies?
If we rely on entitled to receive, it has to come under 3.22, or we must argue that 3.22 is invalidly applied per the footnote in NOVA 3. Neither of those issues have come up yet because we don't have the initial finding of unemployability for at least 10 years.
But we have the board decision that says there is no legal basis for granting the appellant's claim pursuant to 38 U.S.C.A. 1318, presumably applying 3.22 and the eight exceptions.
I don't agree with that, though. The premise of the board's decision is that there was not a pending and unadjudicated claim. That's the point of the disobedience, the point of the contempt, that the board rejected that portion of the court's remand.
Then, counsel, point to me where in 3.22 pending unadjudicated claim is contemplated.
I would say it is not excluded under 3.22, and the specific listings, the specific definition of entitled to receive, which is what 3.22 primarily applies to, that specific definition is too narrow and the regulation is invalid if it excludes from the notion of entitled to receive the concept that a widow or a widower may establish the 10-year rule by pursuing an accrued benefits claim, for example, that might grant an earlier effective date, or even without the accrued benefits claim, although that's getting beyond what the facts of this case involve, too. Either the unadjudicated claim, once it becomes adjudicated, the statute can be construed as constructive receipt, in which case, had it been decided prior to the veteran's death, he would have constructively in receipt of those benefits, or the entitled to receive definition under regulation is too narrow. It's one or the other.
If I can pick up on what the Secretary's argument was with regard to the JMR, mm-hmm. your assertion to us is that once admitting that there was a pending and adjudicated claim, that per se makes it not hypothetical?
Correct.
But if we don't accept that, because it's not specifically listed in 3.22, there's nothing in the JMR that says this isn't a hypothetical entitlement claim. Correct?
Correct.
And at the time, prior to Tarver, there was a possibility that this claim could have been granted under a hypothetical entitlement. theory, yes?
No, not once. Not at one point in time, once the secretary conceded that
I'm saying that the state of the law, if Mrs. Brady had walked into a regional office the day after Rodriguez was decided, but prior to Tarver being decided, in theory, she could have received DIC based on a hypothetical entitlement claim.
If she had a hypothetical entitlement claim, I don't concede that she ever did. We asserted that at one time, but I think that was always wrong, the hypothetical entitlement theory, because the claim, we now know, was always pending and unadjudicated because the secretary has now admitted it.
Well, do you agree that Tarver changed things, or do you think that's not a change in the law? I was trying to clarify your position from your brief.
Tarver did not change the law. Tarver applied Rodriguez. It rejected the effort to carve out an exception for Rodriguez. But again, it just doesn't apply to this claim because once the secretary conceded the pending unadjudicated nature of the TDIU claim, it was not hypothetical anymore. It was the real deal. It had to be adjudicated.
Thank you.
If I may...
Thank you. Your time is up.
All right.
Counsel, I'll give you 30 seconds to wrap up.
I would like to clarify, number one, that the JMR order did not require just a consideration of whether the claim should be referred. It required that the secretary, the board, consider whether it be referred in light of the fact of the pending and unadjudicated claim. That's the decision that the board refused to make, refused to comply with the court's order on that point, said it was not required to do so.
Thank you. The case is submitted for consideration. The court, before adjourning, will come down and greet counsel.
All rise.